Part 11. Cork. Chapter 22. In the early morning, Cork hears a plane passing overhead, flying low and slow. He spots it, a de Havilland Beaver from the U.S. Forest Service, fitted with pontoons, cruising just high enough to reflect the light of the sun, which is not yet above the horizon. He gets on the sat phone. "The pilot has the coordinates you gave us last night," Dross says. "He's flying ahead of you. Deputy Foster is with him. Keep me posted on what you're finding, and I'll keep Foster posted." Then she tells him about her conversations with Stephen and with a detective from the Edina Police Department concerning the events of the night before. "The guy in custody isn't cooperating, won't say a word. They don't have an ID on him yet, but they're working on it." "Does Stephen have any idea what the guy was after?" "The Morisot's mail was being collected by a neighbor. After Dolores left, they got an envelope from Canada addressed to Lou's sister, Belle, containing a map of that country with lots of lines drawn across it, along with a cryptic message, 'Kill Katie.' It looks like one word, but Stephen thinks it's really two words, 'kill and Katie.' Below it is a number, 510. Stephen believes it's a date, maybe the date this Katie is supposed to be killed. There was also a thumb drive, but it's passcode protected, so no idea what's on it. Stephen hasn't got any of this figured out yet, but it's the only lead he has at the moment. I've sent two of my men to pick up the guy you cuffed to a tree yesterday. They'll bring him out of the woods and we'll book him. But if you need help, they can always bypass him and come straight to you." Cork assures her they're fine and they agree to check in at hour intervals unless something comes up that needs immediate attention. He reports what he's learned to Morisot. "A map of Canada," Morisot says. He's chewing on a Slim Jim and an apple that he packed in. "Lou goes to Canada a lot these days. He's told us it has to do with some land deals up there. But what the hell does 'kill Katie' mean?" "Let's hope that Stephen can make some sense of it, and soon," Cork says. "In the meantime, we've got a trail to try to pick up." The early light of the day colors everything blue. They head in the general direction the trail they followed the day before was taking them. The snow is half an inch deep, and the only tracks they find have been left by rabbits and red squirrels. Periodically, they hear the plane engine as it flies a grid, but nothing new comes over the sat phone. Although Cork holds to his faith in Henry Malou, there is a devil in his head telling him that Malou is more than 100 years old. No one that old can hold up long under the kind of hardships he and the two women are facing. Rainey is strong, raised in the North Country, and Cork tells himself that even if Henry falters, she can fend for herself. But as they go 1 mile, then two, then three, with no sign of Henry and the others, and no sign of the trackers, the voice of doubt in his head begins to drown out his hope. "We've lost them," Morisot finally says. "They could be anywhere now," Cork agrees grimly. "Do you know this area?" Morisot asks. "Any idea at all where the old man might be taking them? Or is he just trying his best to stay ahead of these goons?" Cork pulls out the topographic map he's brought and on which he's been keeping track of their progress. Malou's been heading relentlessly north. The boundary waters is enormous, but Malou has been traveling through this wilderness his whole life, and Cork doubts that there's a single acre the old man hasn't explored. Cork, however, has only a vague knowledge of the area they're in now. Looking at the map, he has no idea what's in Malou's head, no idea if the old man has a grand plan or if he and Rainey and Dolores Morisot are just running for their lives. He recalls Malou's advice to quiet all the noise in his head so that he can hear nature speaking to him. He tries. closes his eyes, works to calm himself, but the voice of doubt keeps chipping away at his resolve, and from the woods he hears only silence. "Suggestions?" he says. "If it was me out there, I'd circle east and try to get back to the reservation, to Alouette or to someone there who could help," Morisot says. A good possibility, Cork believes. Still, his own inclination is to continue north, and he says so. "Maybe we should split up," Morisot suggests. "We have one sat phone," Cork points out. "How do we communicate?" "Finding them is the important thing. If they're headed east and I locate them, I can give them some protection. You're going north, deeper into the wilderness. I think you should keep the phone." "You may stumble onto the trackers before you stumble onto our people. Two men with firearms, the odds will be against you." Morisot says, "I'll take that chance." They check the map, make educated guesses about the route Malou might have followed east or north, and Cork reports their decision to Dross.
"Any luck with the search plane?" he asks.
"Nothing so far, but the tree cover's pretty thick. Unless they build a signal fire or find some high open ground and stay put, they could be hard to spot."
"Keep me posted."
He wishes Morisot good luck, and the two men separate. As Cork plods north, he studies the relief of the land, trying to get a sense of Malou's thinking. Was the old man wanting an easy passage, and so he kept between ridges? Or did he want to make it more difficult for those tracking him, and so took to the rocky higher ground when possible? Cork knows that the white blanket of snow may hide soft, marshy ground. So did Malou perhaps try to thread his way through a bog before the snow fell, hoping the trackers would find themselves hopelessly mired? Christ, he tells himself. So many possibilities and no signs at all. The sun, high above the horizon now, is brilliant in the hard blue of the cloudless sky. The wilderness is a patchwork of stark shadows and pale white. The day is warming quickly, however, and the snow is turning to slush under his feet, already vanishing in the sunniest places. He can't hear the drone of the plane anymore, and wonders where it's gone in the search. Then he comes to the footprints in the snow, two sets of booted feet, the trackers. He's confused, however. The footprints come from the north and head south. They turn east along a creek bed where a thread of snowmelt is running between rocks. He resists the urge to plunge up the creek bed. Instead, he follows the boot prints for another quarter mile until he comes to the char of a fire in the protected lee of an outcropping. The same boot prints continue north from there with an identical set returning south. Cork tries to make sense of what he sees. He figures that the men weathered the storm in the protection of the rocks. In the morning, they set out again, headed in the general direction Malou and the others had followed the day before. But they turned around, came back, and followed the creek bed. Why? What did they find that made them turn back? Or maybe they found nothing, and that was the reason. A tracker, when he's lost the trail, returns to where the last sign or most obvious option occurred, the creek bed. Cork thinks about Malou. If they'd come to the creek before the snow gave away their tracks, the old man could have chosen to follow it. The creek bed may well have been dry yesterday and would have been a reasonable point to divert from the relentless trek north. If luck was with them, though Cork suspected that with Malou, nothing was the result of pure luck, the fall of snow would cover any signs they may have accidentally left. The trackers, Cork understands, have caught on to Malou's thinking. He turns double times back to the creek and follows the boot prints. A few hundred yards up the creek bed, he finds tracks that issue from a deadfall of tree limbs.
The tracks were made by moccasins. But there's a set of small boot prints among them. Rainy, Cork thinks, with great relief. He reports what he's found to Dross, who relays the information to the pilot of the search plane. Cork hurries east along the creek bed, hope once again fueling his pace. The call from Dross comes before the next hour's check-in. Cork, the search plane spotted smoke from a small fire at Fish Eye Lake. They flew over the lake. It's too small for a safe landing, but they saw the fire, a smoldering campfire, and something else. From the tone of her voice, he's not sure he wants to hear the rest. Go on. It appears to be Henry Malou. He's lying on the ground next to the fire. He didn't move when the plane flew over. Did they see anyone else? Malou appeared to be alone. And not moving, you say? That's right. Hang on. Cork unshoulders his pack, pulls out the topo map, and unfolds it. He looks for Fish Eye Lake, one of the thousand small bodies of water in that great wilderness, and one that he's not familiar with. Found it, he finally says. It's about 3 miles from my location. The search plane is running low on fuel. They're returning now. After they've refueled, they'll fly back out. Another thing, if Rainey and Dolores had to leave Malou, I'm guessing they'll be headed toward the reservation. We've got a slew of volunteers from the res just itching to join the search. I'm going to send some of them toward Fish Eye Lake along with Deputy Acevedo. God willing, they'll get to our people before the trackers do.
Cork takes a deep breath. I'm on my way.